Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, my guest is Michael Franken of Sioux City. He's a retired three-star admiral in the U.S. Navy, serving in the Navy from 1978 until his retirement in 2017. Also, while this is not the focus of this half hour, he's formerly a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Iowa. In the Navy, Michael Franken served in numerous senior positions prior to his retirement, including deputy head of U.S. Africa Command, flag officer in the U.S. Central Command's Plans and Office Strategy Office, and chief of legislative affairs in the Department of the Navy, and various posts with the Joint Staff and Office of the Secretary of Defense. During his career, he commanded on 24 ships. And we welcome Michael Franken to River to River. Welcome, Admiral.
Well, thank you, Ben. Yeah, no, please just call me Mike or Michael, however you please. That's fine. And thank you for letting me be on the show.
Okay, Michael, thank you for being on. And we want to welcome any listeners who have a question for Michael Franken. 1-866-780-9100. We will be talking about Mike's views on the rapid takeover by the Taliban, the chaotic evacuation of Americans in the country going forward right now, as well as those Afghans who helped coalition forces. Also, reflections on why this war wasn't ended earlier, despite high-ranking officials feeling it was unwinnable. Implications for anti-terrorism, also foreign policy. We're going to try to pack a lot in this half hour with Mike. 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps before we get into your views on Afghanistan, tell us, to what extent did any of your active duty service time involve the coalition effort in Afghanistan?
Well, it began, much like many others, shortly after 9/11. I was a ship captain when 9/11 occurred, and left that job and went to a think tank in the Pentagon that did rather mostly classified work on Iraq and Afghanistan, and did some tribal work in that position. But ultimately, as a commander, ultimately when I was a captain in Navy 06, I was the SecDef operations book presenter for Secretary Rumsfeld, which, to let the listener know, it's the deliberating body that decides what to do, what the U.S. military ought to be doing, and the pros and cons of that. So it is an hourglass look into the intricacies of operations such as OEF and OIF, Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, and the mutations thereof. So I did that as an 06 for 2 years, and then ultimately I was a Commodore. So yes, I had at one time 24 ships as a Commodore in the Persian Gulf and on the Makran coast of Pakistan to do the various array of missions and in support of activity both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then in 2008, as an admiral, I was the plans and policy flag officer in U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida. In that position, I was involved in setting the posture of the Middle East for both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, the movement of capabilities throughout the theater, finding efficiencies in the logistics to support mostly Afghanistan as the Obama administration built up there, and also justifying what we are doing and how we would potentially make an exit. Mm-hmm. A very long tour of and highly taxing, and that's probably where I would draw most of my comments today.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on why the Afghan government forces collapsed so quickly?
Well, historically, Afghanistan's been a territory, much less a nation, that has been easy to enter and difficult to leave. at least leave with your shirt on, so to speak. The most contemporary example as well, besides today, is the Soviets from 1979, but also the most stark example is the first British experience in 1839, which was an absolute debacle. And I would expect that the lessons learned from the previous exits from that area have had an impact on what the Biden administration, how they executed this one. Certainly not without a lot of complaints, well-deserved complaints of not being thoroughly planned, but because the frightfulness of staying in the country when you don't have the support of the government or regional commanders.
So when you were involved at various levels over the course of this war in Afghanistan, how did your opinion of the war, whether it was winnable, whether we understood what we were up against, did that change over time for you personally?
Well, we're always very conscious of that. And I, like many others, were not a student of the Afghan region until we needed to be. And to this day, I think there's a lot to be learned with every passing diplomat and military person who would travel into the area. We've always lagged on what we need to know. But we were told, and we're by our leaders, hey, you guys, quit making fun of us being in Afghanistan and comparing it to Vietnam in a closed office situation. Because in 2003, that's kind of what it looked like. But I will say that the U.S. military in 2004 brought forward an order to the Bush administration to go from about 12,800 personnel in Iraq down to a 2,400 or so level in a step manner. This is in February of 2004. So that because we were changing the scope and the commitment, we rather, after some deliberation and much to my amazement, Secretary Rumsfeld hesitated on that order. And all of us around the table were rather wondering what was the holdup, because that's where we thought we were going as a nation in Afghanistan. And 2 weeks later, we reversed that downward trend and increased by a BCT, a brigade combat team or so, twice a year to a much higher level. That was a shift that we were not expecting in the U.S. military, because we saw perhaps more clearly than many others that this was going to be a very difficult long-term fight. And I'll tell you that as future commanders went into Afghanistan, many of them did so with a rather heavy heart, knowing that although it's on a back burner for America, it was a much more difficult situation to show progress because mm-hmm. society just wasn't ready for what we had to offer.
Comment on what was revealed by what are known as the Afghanistan Papers. These are revelations first published by the Washington Post in 2019. Documents revealing that senior U.S. officials failed to tell the truth about the war in Afghanistan throughout the campaign. Rosy pronouncements they knew to be false, hiding unmistakable evidence that the war had become unwinnable. And, of course, these documents compared to the Pentagon Papers from the Vietnam era. Why in the world was the public deliberately misled by top officials? These are officials, 400 or so of them, for this document. They didn't know that their pronouncements would become public. And yet we were hearing completely different things from all the way up to the president. For example, one quote, and then I'd like you to respond. This is Douglas Lute, a 3-star Army general who served as the White House's Afghan war czar during the Bush and Obama administrations. This is what he told government interviewers in 2015. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing. What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking.
Well, Craig Whitlock of the Washington Post is the author of many of those papers, and he did a superlative job as an investigative journalist in uncovering that and working through the various court cases to get those statements released. Let me begin by saying that strategies, when they're poorly vetted and communicated to the American people, to Congress, et cetera, do not get better with time. And I will harken back to a situation when I was running operations in much of Africa, when I was asked, do something in Burundi. We've got to do something. And I said, what would you have us do? And we hemmed and hawed back and forth, and the crescendo grew very, very loudly. And finally, it was, give me an option of doing something, a military option. So I did. I presented an option, and I'm a Navy guy, but still did some ground stuff. And I purposely scuttled my own plan by saying, this is a really bad idea. This will not go well. And it's rather contrary to what you are as a military person. You want to do what's right, yes, but you also want to be successful. And we encourage that. So, and ultimately, the NSC and others shot that plan down, thankfully. Otherwise, we'd have issues in Burundi today, I would expect. So the mindset is, in a microcosm of time, you do your mission. And you have various set points, various metrics that you measure, from literacy to roads to the increase in number of troops, et cetera. And all of those things can be positive. But ultimately, the world crumbles around you because, A, the society is not ready, or B, they're supporting you because you feed them and you provide them with a service and you're paying them, and life is better while you are there. But they know that you are just transitional. And ultimately, they will have to revert to what they know as their culture. And that's where we get this widening disparity of what is reported versus what is actually happening from a culture perspective.
Where do you stand on this point that's been argued over the last few days, complete withdrawal, which President Biden chose, versus the decision that he didn't make, keeping a residual force, a few thousand there, with the stability of Afghanistan in mind?
I would like to see the investigative work and the thought process behind saying that a 2,000 person reserve force would be helpful. I do believe that that would make an evacuation go, I think, smoother, certainly. But in the end, it's not our job in America to do that mission. And I'm running contrary to many of the military officers that I worked for and worked for me in the course of this. I believe ultimately Afghanistan needs to stand on their feet. And they're going to choose their future. Ultimately, it will not be as we expected, and the Taliban will not be the leaders or the ruling coalition of 1990 or 1998. They will be something a little bit different because the country has changed in the last 20 years for the better. Yes. But it's been a tough, expensive road for America to make that incremental change.
What do you think this means for keeping international terrorism in check? Isn't it a setback in preventing Al-Qaeda or a similar group from striking the U.S., having lost, having no forces in Afghanistan and having the Taliban rule?
I think it is a bigger threat in situ in various nations with the growth of these fringe terrorist organizations. It will ultimately, if Al-Qaeda does grow in Afghanistan, it is a bigger threat to Afghanistan and the region than it is to the United States. Ultimately, we have organizations, we've got areas where we watch for these movements. We are better protected as a country. And ultimately, I don't view that in the top five as a problematic end state here in with our movement out of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. How will this shape our foreign policy going forward? It seems that we caught many of our partners, world partners, off guard, our international allies, also in NATO. How has this rapid withdrawal, the collapse, impacted those important relationships?
My expectation is that the intelligence assessment on President Joe Biden when he was elected president, by an overwhelming margin, I might want to mention, by the Germans, Italians, Argentines, etc., they knew what his sensibilities were in Afghanistan. This is not a surprise to them. It is a bit of wonderment that the nation would fold as fast as it did, but he has a long record of being against our involvement with no identifiable end state in Afghanistan. And I asked the listening audience, what was our identifiable end state? If it was creating a U.S.-like democracy, well, that's completely, pardon the expression, but asinine. And it's got to be something else. And we did some great things, life expectancy, literacy, women's health, women's rights, power, and a host of other things. But ultimately, the Afghans will have to grow into the 21st century at their speed using their form of government.
How is this collapse of the Afghan government and the takeover by the Taliban viewed by our adversaries, chief among them Russia, China, others in that area?
Well, I think there's certainly some smugness, and certainly from in Moscow, I would expect they couldn't be happier. They now, as in the passage of time and as time progresses, they will be more concerned about the movement of refugees, those people from the Tajikistans, Kazakhstans, et cetera, Uzbeks, who are working in Afghanistan, who will now need jobs, and they've usually looked to Moscow for future employment. So there will be a refugee movement into Russia that they'll have to deal with. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Perhaps Russia will be benefited by it. Russia is an interesting nation, and they like to do everything in their power to lessen the statue of America. The Chinese see this as less of an American overwatch of their Western provinces, certainly. They are happy that we are out of the way in some respects, because there's some extractive economic models that they're going to put into play. But they're also a little wary of what this means in their Western provinces. If there's a growth of radical fundamentalism that may cross their border. Mm-hmm. And so it's a mixed bag, and it's a multifaceted, multi-layered answer.
It sounds like you were tending to, I wanted to finish up by asking you what possible scenarios you see developing, a fundamentalist, radical Islamic state, I imagine, on the disastrous end of the spectrum for many reasons. Do you see also a favorable scenario possibly developing? What's the range you see there in the coming weeks and months?
That's the greatest of all questions. And, of course, it's all just a wonder. I don't exactly know, of course. But I would say that the most feasible turnout will be that it will start reasonably well under Taliban. They will then become more difficult on the world stage and internally. They will see that will not be fruitful. And you got to remember that Afghanistan is held together by a very loose confederation of warlords still. And if their standard of living, their quality of life decreases, then you can expect them to raise arms against the Taliban. So like I said before, they have a different nation under that they're looking after. And ultimately, it will be something that will be somewhat like Iran from an Islamic state, ruled in a tribunal situation under perhaps a central leader who is more of a figurehead. They will constantly be needing international aid and humanitarian assistance as they go forward. Okay. This is probably America's best role.
Retired 3-star Admiral Michael Franken of Sioux City joining us live. Michael, welcome. We welcomed you to the show, and we thank you for being on.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Coming up after a short break, we'll continue our Leaving Afghanistan series, conversations with Iowa veterans of Afghanistan. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now we continue our series, Leaving Afghanistan. The goal of this series, to understand personal dimensions of the war by focusing on the individual experiences of Iowans who've really done all types of work in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. Of course, we thank them for their service to our country and service to Afghanistan, for sharing their experiences as well with IPR listeners. You can listen to all of the interviews in this podcast series. Also enjoy photos these veterans have sent us. Find out more by going to iowapublicradio.org/leavingafghanistan. My guest today is Brian O'Keefe of Des Moines. He's a retired military officer, a pilot, aviator. He retired in 2020 after serving 38 years in the military. Beginning in 2010, he had multiple deployments in Afghanistan in various capacities. We'll talk about those. Brian O'Keefe, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
It's a pleasure to have you on our program. Before we get specific about Afghanistan and what you did there, you served nearly 40 years in the military. Give us a quick snapshot of your military career, which I think started way back in the 1980s, right?
Yeah, Ben. 82, I joined the active army as a military policeman. Contractually, I wanted to get to Europe on Uncle Sam's dime, so I did a tour in Frankfurt, Germany, and then I was stationed stateside at Aberdeen Proving Grounds, Maryland. And then I immediately joined the Iowa National Guard in the fall of 85 while I attended a community college here in the Des Moines area.
Yeah, you became a pilot at some point.
Yeah, I did a year in the Iowa National Guard right up in Boone, Iowa as a crew chief. And then they said, hey, you want to go to flight school? And I thought they were joking, but I was honored to be selected. And in 1986, I went to flight school at Fort Rucker, Alabama, learned to fly the old Vietnam-era UH-1 helicopter. And then I returned to Boone while I attended college and flew out of there. Then I transferred to Waterloo, Iowa, flew a gunship and a Cobra gunship there. And then in 1990, the Iowa Guard was asked to provide medevac support for Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I volunteered for that, and so I went back to the Huey, and we activated here stateside and spent 9 months supporting active duty bases in the southwest part of the country during the conflict. 99, I went through here locally in Iowa. As a National Guard pilot, I did counter drug here for 12 weeks, 66 counties, out with local deputies and law enforcement agents looking for marijuana. I've had the privilege of flying cover for presidents as they visit when you're up flying along routes, and so it's a really unique opportunity. And then 2002, I went with the 101st Airborne into Iraq. We were on the initial push, and that was a unique experience. At the time, I was 38, and my commander was 26. Most of the pilots were in their early 20s, so they were experiencing life at a different level than myself. We went to South America 2008 under GWAT, counter counter warfare on terrorism, and we supported the second largest embassy in the world out of Bogota, Colombia, and we were privileged to support the rescue of some Americans who had been held by a terrorist group down there, the FARC. And so that was a neat experience. To celebrate a 4th of July in a U.S. embassy in a foreign country on the rescue of some Americans. 2010-11, we were CENTCOM, ARCENT, as a fixed-wing pilot. It's a small King Air twin-engine turboprop. And we were able, because of our anti-missile capabilities, fly generals and their support staff from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all the little countries through Pakistan and five or six bases into Afghanistan. That was 10-11.
So we're up to 2011. That's quite a resume. I'll say once again, thank you so much for your service to our country. And I know you there's more to come. So we've come up to the timeline in your life where you're in Afghanistan. So you're a member of the National Guard in your first deployment in 2010. You're flying all around the area doing what again?
We are direct support of the generals. So the theater area commanders, they report to the Pentagon, basically. So as they went around and met with different leaders in the other countries around us, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, we went into Iraq quite frequently. So they had that whole area of responsibility. So during that 10-11 period, I made 15 trips up into Afghanistan from... It could be a 24-hour stay to a month stay, but so I was in and out in the Middle East throughout that time period of 10-11.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, 2010, 2011, how hazardous, how risky is it flying in and out of the Kabul airport?
That wasn't the greatest concern. There were smaller bases that were less defended. There's, you know, they have a CRAM counter rocket and mortar system that has Gatling guns that engage, you know, anything larger than anything they perceive as a threat. So mortars, rockets, artillery. So they were pretty good at knocking those down. Sadly, there were engagements where they were trying to penetrate perimeters. But Kabul itself was more of a pilot challenge than a threat from an enemy.
Mm-hmm. Take us through more of your experiences in Afghanistan. What next?
Well, we had an opportunity to visit all the bases, so the larger ones from the north, Mazar Sharif, Herat to the west, Kandahar to the south, and then some of the smaller ones in between. And it was based off of future operations, you know, on a larger scale that generals were planning further out, whether it was the development of a base, relationships with the locals, and then ensuring that just from a morale standpoint that they're getting the things they need to be able to defend themselves and be ready to take action if needed.
Mm-hmm. You returned to Afghanistan. Just looking at your resume, after this initial time, you returned in 2013, 2015, 2016. How did your role, your deployments change in those cases?
The Army and the Air Force provide a medium altitude reconnaissance surveillance platform to support the commanders and also the soldiers. It was a NATO level. We supported Afghans and any other country that was participating in operations in northern Afghanistan. So we had everything from just south of Kabul towards the Pakistan border up into the Hindu Kush to the north. So we would be out everything from finding and tracking high-value targets, doing patterns of life on areas that the Special Forces, Army, Brits were going to do an infill or do an assault to, whether it's Taliban, or we would even locate, you know, when they make explosives with fertilizers and such. So we had the eyes and ears capabilities to monitor everything from activities. I look for roadside bombs. We could detect soil disturbance and activities that you kind of learn if there's trouble or mm-hmm. an ambush that's coming about. So that was the primary platform. And basically if they're going to have a big mission or a high threat mission, that aircraft was on site before, during, and after an event because they knew the value would be provided.
When you say high value target, you're trying to detect those and eventually neutralize them. In real terms, what are some examples of high value targets that you would see and then deal with?
Well, you know, these are individuals that were designated, you know, beyond my level. My function and purpose was provide that platform. So my backseater and people monitoring our transmissions could do a positive ID on someone. But you monitor what they're doing, who's around them, what information, what equipment. There's a lot of intel that is valuable by seeing who comes and goes around somebody. Kind of based off other intel we'd get to say, we want to track this person for a period just to see if they're ones making decisions at that time.
So your role is to fly the aircraft, and you've got people in there doing all these other identification and analyzing things. And if you confirm a high-value target, does the fire come from your aircraft as well?
No, we don't have any offensive weapon systems on board. They call it a stack, but you could be over a target and have Apache helicopters, A-10s, F-18s, B-1 bombers that are all immediately available to engage depending on the need or the weapons choice that they feel is necessary to engage that target.
I want to remind our listeners, if you've just joined us, Brian O'Keefe of Des Moines is with me, a retired military officer, pilot, aviator, serving nearly 40 years in the military, retiring in 2020. And we're zeroing in on his deployments, his service in Afghanistan. And I believe at the end of your times, your deployments in Afghanistan, you also worked as a civilian contractor?
Yeah, they switched. So like when I was there in 10-11, it was probably 80% military, 20% contractors. And then when I was back there in 16, it was reversed. It was more contractors than civilians. So I was flying the same mission but providing the same information. It's just that I was doing in a pair of jeans and a T-shirt.
Mm. When you think back on your time in Afghanistan and over multiple years, multiple deployments, what are the chief memories that stand out most for you, Brian?
Well, the thing I got out of it was the friendships and relationships and the unique opportunities I had as an officer and as a pilot to go around that country and see people that were maybe there for the first time or isolated to an area of Afghanistan that, you know, they don't see or know what's going on outside their walls or within 10 miles of them. So flying with generals, you know, they don't brief or discuss anything with us, but you kind of can pick up based off of who they're talking with and how things happen after some visit we make with somebody. But it was amazing at Bagram, especially being based out of there, that, you know, that's the main hospital, that's the main hub. So you got to see people on their worst day, whether they're being brought in by a stretcher or meeting a guy that would just escorted in his buddy that was flown in KIA, and he's getting, you know, the body to the morgue in Bagram. Seeing guys all excited, FaceTiming their wife because he gets to go home for, you know, baby delivery. So Bagram was quite unique, and like I said, because as an officer, as a pilot, I wasn't tasked with a ton of other duties. I flew, you know, 6 days a week, but any time I had off, I like to spend it in, we call them like a USO or a little rec building, and you just look for that young soldier that's got that 1,000-yard stare, and I'd take the opportunity to go visit with him and see how their day's going.
That sounds like it was really needed in this case. Is there one of these instances, experiences, a story that you can share that you think back on either fondly or otherwise that left an imprint on you?
Well, just in the last week or so, with the overrun of Kabul and the lack of action by the Afghan military, it reminds me of April of 2011 when I was in Kabul and we were waiting on a passenger to depart. But the big voice or the sirens going off, which usually indicates an attack by artillery or mortar or rocket, but I couldn't hear anything, and we departed. But I found out that while I was standing there, just down the ramp on the runway at Kabul, an Afghan officer, a pilot for the Afghan Air Force, had been he'd been challenged by the U.S. Air Force about illegal use of some equipment, and he stood up and killed all nine of them right in this conference room. And so, that stuck with me, knowing that some Afghans that I saw when I was out doing reconnaissance stuff, that, you know, they work both sides. They have family that's part of the Taliban or ISIS, and they put on the uniform, and I just never felt that commitment from them as you did from your fellow NATO soldiers.
So this didn't come as a very much of a surprise to you, that the Afghan government forces collapsed so quickly?
No, because, there's the traditional fighting season, and these soldiers would just go AWOL and leave and go back to their village or back into Pakistan. But, they wanted the I don't know any on a personal level, but I know that they failed at their duties. That once we turned over small military compounds, I was up in northern Afghanistan monitoring the border, and they weren't there. They failed to even show up to monitor borders, which of course is a major concern when there's criminal activity and ISIS movement.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the Afghan people now? Of course, there's all kinds. There's Taliban, so Afghan people who are Taliban. There are others who, many thousands who worked with the coalition forces, including yourself, I imagine. What are your thoughts about the future of the Afghan people?
Well, we're the fifth empire that's tried to go in there and establish some democracy and capitalism, free trade, but to me, they're a third world country, and they're tribal, and they don't recognize borders. They recognize family, and the rest of us are just a necessary evil that they take advantage of our compassion and money and training and funding. But they'll move on without us.
Mm-hmm. In recent years, most notably in 2019, I think it was the Washington Post and the Afghanistan papers, showing, discussions, high-level discussions going way back, that this war was not winnable, despite the public pronouncements to the contrary. I wonder, while you were serving in 2010 through 2016 in those multiple deployments there, if you had any sense of where this war was going, whether it was winnable, what you and your colleagues thought over there, or are you not thinking about that?
No, we do, because basically our soldiers they would commit to a fight, whether they were ambushed or they were doing an assault themselves. But I mean, I watched from above where we would get ambushed, and as soon as we started shooting back or brought in some air support, they could just set down their weapons and walk back into the village and, go back to their everyday life. And we were limited by our rules of engagement where, there was a couple times where we could have engaged a threat that was engaging our people, and we couldn't because couldn't confirm the occupancy of certain buildings, and they were worried about collateral damage or, women and children not involved. So it was frustrating that they could shoot until they got tired, but our guys couldn't take full advantage of our capabilities to defend themselves.
So what did that tell you at the time about their commitment to what you thought you were fighting for and other coalition forces were fighting for?
Well, my thing, and 38 years is I'm there for my fellow soldier, airman, marine. you know, I don't get all the intel. I don't get the big picture. My job's to, you know, just to be ready to do what they've asked me to do, the best of my abilities. And that was the pride I took in it, that, you know, I was ready every day to fly, and mm-hmm. I was going to stay on target, given, you know, providing them the best information so they could stay safe or take action if that was necessary.
Right. Brian, in conclusion, you sent us a number of really interesting photos, and we're asking for and receiving many photos from the veterans we interview for this series. Tell us about a favorite photo or two that you sent us. Describe it.
I don't recall all of them. I know the ones that, you know, when I'm with the aircraft there with, that was my first flight in Afghanistan, and that's always a exciting moment when you're operating a new aircraft. I was trained and certified in it, but you land in Afghanistan, and 72 hours later, you're up in the air, and those are always exciting when you get back on the ground. You got that under your belt, and now you know you're ready to operate in that environment.
Mm-hmm. With so many threats around you, having to just operate in a different way, especially as a pilot of a helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft, you're on your guard all the time. What is it then like to readjust to civilian life? Because you went back and forth so many times.
I do notice some things once in a while. My neighborhood just added planted trees, and they use little 5-gallon buckets, you know, to keep the trees, the young trees watered. And that was a common method for the Afghans to, they would use 5-gallon buckets to trigger rockets so they could set them, walk away, and the water trickled out, then the rockets would fire. So that was always, as a reconnaissance pilot, we were always looking for people around the base that were trying to shoot at. So as I walked by those, you know, I wonder if they're still using those buckets. I look, when I see a heavy loaded car, I think about vehicles that were loaded down with 200-pound bombs that they used to use in Iraq. Yeah, there's just things that you kind of think twice and say, no, that's not. You're safe and you're okay.
Yeah. Brian, wow. Thank you for sharing just a small slice of your experiences in the military over nearly 40 years in the military. You retired in 2020. Brian O'Keefe of Des Moines, retired military officer, pilot, as you just heard, beginning in 2010, multiple deployments in Afghanistan in various capacities. And we didn't even get to talk, perhaps we will in the future if you'd like, about your service in Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War, way back in the early 1990s, and the Iraq War, briefly mentioned in this conversation. Brian, I want to thank you so much again for your service and for your willingness to share your experiences with Iowa Public Radio listeners.
It's been a pleasure. I enjoyed this time together.
I want to let you know that if you served in Afghanistan and would like to share your story on Iowa Public Radio, please email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River today, produced by Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.